Erev Tov, good evening. Let us get started. Before we do, Courtney is not with us this evening. I haven't got a hold of him, but I believe today was his appointment to find out whether or not he was getting his gallbladder out today or not. I haven't heard, but I do know, I believe today was at least the appointment to have all that stuff tested and so forth. Also, I know many of you in this class probably know of Beata Baker and her health situation. She's gotten some pretty difficult news this weekend. And even if you don't know the situation, just in your prayers, if you could remember just the name Beata. Just some very challenging news. She's taking it well, but still nonetheless very difficult. All right, so let us begin with our blessing, and then we will dive into our Hebrew lesson for the week. Baruch atah Adonai, Eloheinu melech ha'olam, asher kidishanu b'mitzvotav, v'sivanu le'esok b'divrei Torah. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with thy commandments and has commanded us to immerse ourselves in the matters of Torah. Amen. All right, handouts are on the end of the table. If you haven't got one, just request to be passed down to you, but there should be enough on each of the tables there for you. Okay, everyone got one? All right. This week we're going to be looking at Parashat Vayachel. Again, parashat, just a Hebrew word that means section, set of verses, what we in English in our liturgical traditions would call a pericope. Okay? A pericope. Or as my rabbi friend likes to say, pericope. But pericope is the same, means the lectionary reading, basically. Okay, so we're going to be looking at Exodus 35, the first part of the first verse of Exodus chapter 35 here for our Hebrew lesson. As usual, I'll read it, I'll translate a little bit, talk a little bit about it, then we'll recite it together. Again, the key is just to get familiar hearing it, and see if you can pick out some familiar vocabulary words and so forth. Best way to learn the language. So, Vayachel Moshe et kol adat b'nei Yisrael. So, we have our Vav. It's back, right? I think last week was the first time we didn't have the Vav. So, it's back. What is our Vav? And, okay. Vayachel. Now, this is, we've got the Yod, so that tells us what? Third person, masculine, singular. This is a little tricky one, though. It is third person, masculine, singular, but it's what's known as a hithil. So it has this idea of being caused to do this. So the verb here, kahal, means to assemble or to gather, but in this hithil means to be caused to be assembled, to be caused to gather. So, and he causes a gathering. And now we go looking for our subject. The next word is Moshe. What is Mohu? What is Moshe?
Moses.
So, and Moses causes this gathering. Now, that verb, to haul, we're going to talk about it some more. It's right here. We're going to talk about that some more in its relationship to the church. So, Vayachel Moshe and Moses causes this gathering, this kohol. Et, what is et? Remember that? It doesn't get translated. It's a direct object marker, letting you know that what's attached to that hyphen is the direct object of that verb. So, Moses causes the gathering of kol, a dot, all the congregation. A dot. We're going to also talk about a dot when we get to our discussion on the church. Means congregation or gathering as well. So Moses causes this gathering of all, because call means all, all the congregation of B'nai Yisrael, sons of Israel, or the more politically correct translation, the children of Israel. But B'nai is actually the plural of son. So when Moses causes an assembly of all the congregation of the sons of Israel, that's our translation there. Again, the two big words that we're going to focus on in a little bit is Kahal, which is where we get Kohel and different other variations, and Adat, which is where we get Moed and festivals and gatherings and so forth. So, Vayakel Moshe et Kol Adat B'nai Yisrael. Alright, so let us say it together. Vayakel Moshe et Kol Adat B'nai Yisrael. Alright, very good. Very good. So, let's talk about the parashat in a nutshell, kind of get a summary of what's going on. And by the way, next week is going to be a bit of a challenge for me because there are 54 divisions in the parashat to cover a year. Now, the Jewish year is different than ours. It's lunar-based, where ours is solar-based. But still, it averages out to about 52 weeks. It can have less, and it can have more. When it has less than 54, how do you think they get all 54 divisions read? They combine them. Now, this week's and next week's parashat are almost always combined. Okay. Now, they are sometimes separated, but these two are almost always combined. And it's because of their subject content. Okay, because they're almost identical, and so forth. And so, it's a bit of a challenge on what I'm going to do next week, because, you know, kind of shooting it all this week here, good stuff. But these are kind of the first two that would be combined, let's say, if our Jewish year was going to have 51 weeks. These two would be combined so that we would shorten the number of readings. Now, this week's parashat covers Exodus chapter 35 all the way through chapter 38, verse 20. And just a quick overview of some of the material. Moses assembles, again, that kahal, the people of Israel, and he reiterates to them the commandment to observe the Shabbat. And then he conveys God's instructions regarding the making of the Mishkan. What's the Mishkan? Tabernacle. Now, why would Moses first reiterate the Sabbath commandment and then admonish the people to bring their offerings? Well, actually, it's quite clear what's going on. The bringing of the materials for the construction of the Mishkan, the tabernacle, was to be done from a heart of gratitude for the covenant God had made with Israel. The Sabbath was the sign of that covenant, and the tabernacle was the central revelation of God's way of salvation within the covenant through the work of a mediator priest offering the sacrifices. And so the arrangement of the text in which the Sabbath commandment precedes the request for contributions teaches us that access to the tabernacle was available only to those who were covenant members. One could not be an outsider to the covenant and expect to have communion with God via the tabernacle. Or to put it another way, one could not expect to enjoy the fellowship that's offered in the tabernacle if one was not willing to accept the covenant that God had revealed. Here, as it is throughout Scripture, what we see is a close marriage of obedience and faith. Obedience and faith are inseparable partners of a single reality. And this is where, in many ways, the church, in her efforts to preserve salvation by grace alone, never really likes to talk about obedience. And it never likes to talk about how you should be obedient. Because if I do that, I just might be so afraid you'll think I'm teaching you're saved by what you do and by being obedient that I'll just shy away from that altogether. But the reality is that faith and obedience are two sides of the same coin. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a very beloved Lutheran pastor who was martyred during the Nazi regime, put it best when he said, "The faithful are obedient, and the obedient are faithful." And so we see that kind of being married together here in the way that this parashat opens. The people donate the required materials in abundance, bringing their gold, their silver, the copper, blue, purple, and red dyed wool, the goat hair, the spun linen, the animal skins, the wood, the olive oil, the herbs, and the precious stones. And so Moses, in fact, has to tell them enough. And the admonition to the people that they bring offerings of goods and materials needed for the tabernacle and its furnishings, it was met with this incredibly joyful response, a very happy compliance. We hear no grumbling here, no complaining about this, no saying, I worked hard for this, or I don't want to give up this, or I shouldn't be asked to do this much. The people were so moved in their hearts, they gave abundantly. In fact, so much so that Moses said, let no man or woman any longer perform work for the contributions of the sanctuary. And so the people were literally restrained from bringing and giving more. Now, what do you think brought about this great response? What had pretty much just happened, or at least just been forgiven them?
A golden calf incident.
It had been forgiven them on the 10th of Tishrei, and this is essentially happening on the 11th of Tishrei. So it's very fresh in their minds that they all should be forsaken by their God, that they all should be abandoned, that God should have, you know, indeed smote them and began a new people with Moses. And so their response is fueled by this amazing grace of God given to them after their sins have been forgiven. Also, an important point is being illustrated that echoes in the teachings of Yeshua. Yeshua says, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The treasures we have are not only material wealth and money, but it's also our time and our life energy. They not only were to give for the furnishings and all the things to make the tabernacle, but they were to also be involved in its actual construction. Okay, so it's not just wealth and money, but also time and our very energy. And so the parashat is a reminder that as our hearts are more and more given over to loving God, then we will willingly use such to accomplish and advance His kingdom. Then the parashat tells us that a team of wise-hearted artisans make the Mishkan and its furnishings. This was detailed for us in three previous parashat, three previous weeks, specifically Teruma, Tetzaveh, and last week in Kitisa. Things like the three layers of roof coverings, the 48 gold-plated wall panels, the 100 silver foundation sockets, the veil that separates the sanctuary from the two chambers, the screen that goes in front of it, the ark and its cover with the cherubim, the table and the showbread, the seven-branched menorah, and the specially prepared oil, the golden altar, the incense that burned on it, the anointing oil, the altar for burnt offerings, the hangings, the posts, the foundations for sockets for the courtyard, the basin, its pedestal, being made out of copper mirrors. Okay, we could go into the word copper, but we won't. It's kind of fun to do that because it takes us back to the Kosh serpent, but maybe next year we get to this parashat. Yeah, that's true. Now, anyone who read this week's parashat before class, have a feeling of deja vu at all? Hopefully, because it's almost verbatim what you read in all those other three. But we're going to talk about why then is it repeated, and what is the difference? There's a few little word changes. And so we're going to focus on that. That's coming up. But right now I want to talk about the church and the Torah. Now, last week you guys didn't play fair when I asked my question. Okay, so I hesitate to ask this question because I know you probably won't play fair this week. But how many of you think or have thought, have been taught, have had an inkling towards, perhaps aren't sure but think that sounds at least sort of correct, that the whole idea of the church is a New Testament concept, that the church came about because Jesus founded the church? How many have thought that? Oh, roughly in the ballpark of that. Okay, so you got some that are going to play the game. All right, good. Most Christians do. Not just because sometimes it's explicitly taught that way. Sometimes Acts chapter 2, the birthday of the church, as if that means, okay, what's a birthday? It's being born, meaning it didn't exist before this. But we're going to see, hopefully, through just the study of the language of the Bible itself, that it's really, that's not true. That the church is not a New Testament institution, and it is not something that Jesus created or founded. Now, he may be the rock of it, he may be the cornerstone of it, and all those other great confessions, but it existed before his earthly ministry. And the reason we don't always get this is because of our English translations. I even verified this. I have a nice software program that has about, 40 or 50 English translations of the Bible, and not a single one of them has the word church in the Old Testament. Okay? And yet, it's in the New Testament. So, that would lead you to think what? That's, I mean, obviously, if it were around before, it would have appeared in somewhere in those first 39 books. Okay? So, church never appears in the Old Testament. It only appears in the New Testament. But my question is that really true? Is that really true? Well, it's true for most English versions. In fact, it's true for those 40 or 50 English translations I looked. If you find one, please let me know. But I would be, I'll give you a shekel from Israel if you find that. Right? But it is not true for the Greek and the Hebrew versions of the Bible. And here is a case where one's theological bias influences one's translation choices. And let me explain. The parashat that we have this evening, and it begins in Exodus 35, begins with Moses assembling the whole Israelite congregation. The verb used for assemble is kahal. And this Q is pronounced ka, because you use a K in transliteration for the kuf. So, kahal. Okay? That's the vayakel. That's the kahal. Means to assemble. One of the words, which in its noun form, passes in the Greek version, the Septuagint. The Septuagint is the Greek translation of your Old Testament, the Tanakh. And it was around at the time of Yeshua and the apostles. The apostles would have known of at least a Septuagint tradition. That is, a Greek version of their Holy Scriptures for the Hellenistic Jews. Okay? The ones that were born in diaspora and didn't really know their Hebrew and so forth. So, what does the Septuagint do in Exodus 35, verse 1? What verb, what noun does it associate with the noun for kahal? It associates this Greek word, ekklesia. What do you see in ecclesia? Ecclesiastical, right? Okay, church. Okay, but we're going to find out ecclesia doesn't mean church. So the Septuagint understands kahal as ecclesia. Okay? Kahal and ecclesia. That's the Hebrew and Greek equivalents here. Okay? More so, I went into a Hebrew New Testament and looked at Matthew 16 and was curious how a Jew reading their New Testament would understand what would it use for church. Guess what it uses? Kahal. Okay, so ecclesia, both from going from Hebrew to Greek in the Old Testament and going from Greek to Hebrew in the New Testament, have these two being the word choices, the same word choices. Okay? Ecclesia gets translated in your New Testaments as church. But you know what? Technically speaking, and especially in the first century, ecclesia does not mean church. What do you think it means? Assembly, gathering. In fact, it's what was used in reference when the government got together. It was an ecclesia.
Okay, so it didn't mean church. So either, here's your question. Why doesn't my Old Testament translate kahal as church? Or why doesn't my New Testament translate ecclesia as assembly?
Someone
has a very clear agenda. Now, if we read this and understand this, then you can back translate it in our understanding in Moses, in Exodus 35, that Moses gathers the church. Because kahal is ecclesia. So he's churching up the people. He's putting them together, their church. Why would a translator not want to put Moses is gathering them into a church? Or why would he want to say for Jesus, on this rock I'm going to build my gathering and my assembly? Okay. But there's more. Similarly, the word translated as congregation, which is also in Exodus 35 verse 1, a dot, right here. Okay. Call a dot, all the assembly. Okay. It has to do with something that is appointed. And word derived from it is moed, which basically, if you just put a mem in front of it, some linguistics changes that to a vav. Moed, anyone know what moed is? It's the word used in Leviticus 23, verse 1, to designate the biblical festivals, the specific appointed times. Passover, Sukkot, Yom Kippur, Pentecost, the seven festivals. Those are Moedim. Those are the Moeds, if you will. Okay. In Greek, what did the Septuagint do in Leviticus 23? What did it do with the dot and Moedim and so forth? Guess what it translated it as? Ecclesia. Okay. And sometimes it translated it as synagogue, synagogue. Okay. Synagogue, all it means is assembly as well. But specifically an assembly gathered for biblically ordained worship. So the church, the assembling or gathering of God's people for worship in appointed times, it's not something that's new to Acts chapter 2. And it's not something new to the Gospels or with Jesus. It's as old as Moses. Now, how did we get this whole concept of church? And this is what's important for you to realize. Do we have any linguistic buffs in here? Anyone never heard of a proprietary eponym? All right. It's very similar to this concept. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. I could have in my hand a can that says Pepsi. Or I could have in my hand a drink that says Sprite in a green can. And if you said, what you drinking? Guess what I say as one from Atlanta? Drinking a Coke. Or what would you like to drink? I'll take a Coke and I could bring you Fanta Orange. And you would think, thanks for the Coke. I mean, you wouldn't think, this isn't a Coke. Okay, that's a proprietary eponym. Can you make me a Xerox of that? Xerox copy? Well, no, we have a Sony in there. Is that okay? Okay. I need a Kleenex. I can give you my sleeve and that's going to pass. Well, these are all things that were once meant something specific, but because not only of market dominance, but because of mind dominance, they became genericized is the term. Okay? So, ecclesia in the first century, Greek mind, or kahal or adot, okay, were especially ecclesia. It was just a gathering. Again, the Roman senators gathered for ecclesia. They weren't worshiping Jesus, folks. They were doing government business. But it was an ecclesia. But because by the 4th, 5th, 6th century, the group that kept saying ecclesia that basically became to dominate the world and said, convert or we kill you, ecclesia became an eponym, essentially, for an institution. And so to think the idea that church as we know it, as Emmanuel Lutheran Church and so forth, is the church that Yeshua speaks of in Matthew 16 and so forth, he had no way. Absolutely no way. No. The whole idea of an institution like what goes on for the church, the ecclesia, no. And also the whole idea that in the New Testament, the other day I heard someone, they were expounding on the number 12 as the number of the church. And I'm like, what are you talking about, the number of the church? And he goes through all this discussion. I'm like, that's not the number of the church. That's the number of the Kahal. That's the number of Israel. Okay. But again, this had become an ethnonym. In the first century, this didn't mean church. And how we even get church from ecclesia is a nice little linguistic story going into the old English of kirka and kirk. Like even in Scotland now, if you go to church, you go to a kirk and so forth. So it's very important that you get the idea of now when you think back to Yeshua's words, when he talks about take it to the church, and he speaks about the church, I want you to be thinking Kahal and Adat, Moedim. And the Kahal was like for Moses. It was a sacred assembly designed to get something official done with the people of God. That's the Kahal. The Adat is more the specific kind of religious focus, the Moedim and so forth. But like, first century, there was no synagogue membership. You know, like you didn't go synagogue shopping and find the rabbi you liked the most and the denomination that suited you, and then go through an 8-week member instruction and then go stand in front. And so, no, that's not what ecclesia is. So it's a case of where the English language has changed the meaning of the word over time. And this happens in all kinds of words. For instance, quick. Those who know your old version of the Apostles' Creed, what's quick mean? Alive. Quick in the dead. Quick, no one thinks alive anymore. All right? Or even to be a little controversial, yay. Right? Okay. No, we all kind of know because of our probably inappropriate jokes and so forth. Once upon a time it meant merry and joyful and happy. No one uses gay that way anymore. No one. The language has changed. You need to be aware church has changed. Now, too often in today's individualistic world, even believers forget the importance of community. This is especially true for those who desire to follow the Torah. The Torah was given to Adat Yisrael. Adat Yisrael. In other words, the Israel that gathered around those sacred festivals. To the appointed community of Israel. In Greek, this would have been Ecclesia Yisrael. The Church Israel. Now imagine that. Go back to that Hebrew lesson. Kol Adat B'nai Yisrael. If we're going to be equivalent and say, let's everywhere we see Adat, let's translate it as Ecclesia, and then let's translate Ecclesia the way the New Testament translators translate Ecclesia. Then you would have, and Moses causes an assembly of all the church of the sons of Israel. Now, how do you find me an Old Testament that translates it that way? Why? Why don't they do that? We know very clearly the relationship between these words. Why don't they do that? It's precepts being carefully crafted by the Holy One to be lived out as a team, as a community, a holy partnership. This is what a kahal is. It's a holy partnership, a community. It's about community, not membership. It's about relationship, not just saying that's where I go on a certain day of the week. Everyone works together as a group to live out God's calling. And so when Yeshua speaks about his ecclesia, his call, he's speaking about those who are gathered around a holy partnership
for the purposes of his teachings. Thus, one will only be able to genuinely fulfill a biblical mitzvah when it's done within a community. Okay? The Holy One gave his Torah to a holy community, to an assembly, to a church. You can use the word church. There's nothing wrong with using the word church, so long as you understand it's kahal, and so that word gets to get put in your Old Testament too. It's not a New Testament concept. And it was given to a community, not to any one individual. God purposely involved the whole community in fulfilling the Torah about the tabernacle. The calling of the Torah cannot be fulfilled only by single individuals. It was designed by God to be fulfilled by each individual living out a calling within a holy community. This is the idea of what a church really is. Okay? Because we all know someone can, quote, join our church and really not be part of the church. Again, I don't know how many times I've read in the obituaries where someone's a member of Emmanuel Lutheran Church that I've never met or heard of. But they're a member. They may be a member in our new understanding of church, but they're not a member of the kahal. No one individual could take credit for any finished product, and the real beauty was a cumulative effort for all of Adat Yisrael. In the Apostles, the tabernacle is identified with the Ecclesia, the body of Messiah. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 refers to us as the temple, and we've talked about that a few weeks ago. And corporately, we are the place where the Holy One desires to dwell. So, just keep in mind, church, as we know it, is not ecclesia. Ecclesia is kahal and adat. Again, that's looking at the original Hebrew as it got translated into the Greek. That's also looking in the New Testament at the, quote, original Greek and how it got translated into the Hebrew. That's your parallel. Okay. And I think, you know, one of the things we're most guilty of is what I would call direct transference. We're guilty of, we live in the 21st century, we crack open our Bibles and we start to read it, and all those words and everything, we immediately assume it's written in the 21st century, and everything means what it means to us in the 21st century. It doesn't. You will not get the correct understanding of the Scriptures if you do that. Because you'll come away with Jesus established the church. Okay, which will mean it's something new and then it replaced something, right? Because something existed before it. You see where that goes? Making of the tabernacle. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai, he churches together the church of Israel and told them to build the tabernacle. Now here we have another fractal involving Moshe and the Mashiach. Again, when we first started the book of Shemot, Exodus, I said, keep your eyes open for these numerous, numerous fractals between these two. We've discussed many as we've gone. Here is another one. For when a Messiah comes, he will gather together his assembly, his church. It's okay to call it a church, as long as you know the context. He will come for his church, his kahal, from the four corners of the world and rebuild his father's house. Exodus chapter 35, verse 21 says, everyone whose heart stirred him and everyone whose spirit moved him came and brought the Lord's contribution for the work of the tent of meeting and for all its services and for the holy garments. Now, the assembly, the church, the kahal, the ecclesia of Messiah, is a fractal and spoken of metaphorically as the temple. That is, as I said before, the temple is a metaphor, a foreshadowing, a type, a fractal of the body of Messiah. And so when you read these portions of the Torah that seem so minutiae about the shape of the tabernacle and the kind of furniture and all these things, keep in mind that's 3D flat land, okay, of trying to express a reality that you can't quite grasp in its fullness. So it's dumbing it down. In other words, it's the one-dimensional dot, you know, and the two-dimensional square trying to explain to the dot both height and width, you know, and the dot can't quite figure it out, and the square can't, you know, figure out a cube, you know. That's not a three-dimensional cube, okay? It's a representation of it on a very flat surface. And so, much like we live in a 3D world, you know, you take advanced mathematics, complex analysis, and so forth, you start talking about there are infinite dimensions. There are four dimensions, you know, there's a fourth dimension. Well, how do we describe a fourth dimension in a three-dimensional world? Well, we can't. We have to create models for it, and so forth. Well, the tabernacle in this world of action did everything it's described as doing in the book of Exodus, but it was also a model of, as the book of Hebrews would describe it, the tabernacle not made with hands. Okay, we can't grasp that right now. That's fourth dimension, if you will. And so we were given something that we could kind of get our hands around. And so don't just get lost in the details of that. Just like the high priest, you know, each one of those garments represented a specific aspect of the Messiah, a specific aspect of what he was going to do, of his character, of his nature, of his ministry, of his mission, of how he was going to do it. All of that, those were flatland representations of a greater reality. And so the church, okay, the assembly, the kahal, it too is a fractal. In 1 Corinthians 6, verse 19, Paul reminds us that we are to function as the holy temple of God. And again in 2 Corinthians 6, he says we are the temple of the living God. But remember, Moses did not build the tabernacle. He brought down the instructions, but the people did the building. And here we have another fractal that teaches us that the assembly, the kahal, the ecclesia, the church of Messiah, is created by the individuals within it. Just as the Israelites labor to make the various components of the tabernacle, we labor together to create the assembly, the ecclesia, the church of Messiah on earth. The responsibility falls upon us. And unless we contribute to the project and set our own hands to the task, the work does not get done. The Israelites all brought different gifts as they were able. They labored in different departments and gave their various talents to complete the tabernacle. In the same way, we all have different roles and we function within this assembly, this church, with those roles. So in 1 Corinthians 12, Rav Shaul, the Apostle Paul, turns to the body of Messiah to explain this concept. He points out that a human body is comprised of many parts. One believer may be likened to a foot, another a hand, another an ear, still another an eye. The body is healthy only when all the various parts of the body are functioning in their God-given roles. It doesn't work out well when the foot decides it's going to be a hand. It doesn't work out when the leg is broken and so forth. Paul further employs the metaphor, the fractal, to illustrate how ridiculous it is for some parts of the body to be envious of others. Though the body is comprised of different kinds of people, Paul would say Jews and Greeks, slave and free, and just as different members bring different gifts to the body, we are all one in the kahal of Messiah. Paul says there are a variety of ministries, yet the same Lord. Now in this body of Messiah fractal, Yeshua is likened to the head. Now remember I said that the tabernacle and then eventually the temple were fractal not only of the one made without hands, and a fractal of Messiah, but also a fractal of our body and a body. Keter, and it's a fractal, by the way, of this thing. Keter is a Hebrew word that means head, the crown. And so Paul, think about Paul's letters. Does he not speak a lot about the wisdom of God and understanding
and the grace of God, and the beauty of God, and the beauty of what we've been given in Christ? Does he not speak about rules and structures and what's allowed and what's not allowed? Does he not speak about our foundation and who our foundation is? He tells us, he's describing, by the way, the tree of life for you in all of these vocabulary words. And he tells us, this is Christ. This is Jesus. This is Yeshua. He's the Keter. He's the head. Okay? And so Yeshua is likened to the head. And Paul says, Messiah is the head of the body, the head of the ecclesia, the kohol. And he reminds us to hold fast to the head, from whom the entire body, being supplied and held together by the joints and ligament, grows with a growth which is from God. Meaning, theoretically, though it would be painful and difficult and I would not function up to my full capacity as a human being, I could live without my arm. Again, I would be handicapped. Okay, I couldn't do everything somebody with both arms could do. Okay, I could accomplish a lot, I could overcome a lot, and so forth, but obviously my life would be somewhat different. I don't know anyone that has lived without their head, right? And that's Paul's point. So it's going to start here and flow down. All right. Bezalel, he's also a fractal of Messiah. When Moses received the Torah at Sinai, he was given visions of the tabernacle, the Mishkan. It was a tent-like structure where God's presence, the Shekinah, would dwell. To dwell means Shekhan. So you get Shekinah and as presence, Shekhan related to dwell. And so in this tent-like structure, God's presence is going to dwell in the camp of Israel. Though Moses received the pattern, in Hebrew it's Tavnit, and you know what Tavnit can get translated as? Fractal. So it's right there in the Torah. I'm not even making it up. Okay. It says Moses received the fractal. Okay. Guess what? I was picking that up. That was my own invention, and it wasn't. The Torah tells us Moses received the fractal of a heavenly dwelling. In other words, he's told very clearly, you are getting instructions for this world of action, Asiyah, this world of action, of a higher reality. Yeah. A greater reality, heaven to dwell. Moses was unable to create the artifacts himself. And there are some wonderful stories in the Talmud about how he tried and failed and so forth and so forth. But he was unable to. And so God called Bezalel to be the chief architect of the structure. Now, Bezalel, he's the grandson of Hur. Hur is of the tribe of Judah, who is an ancestor of King David, and who, according to Josephus in his Antiquities, was the husband of Moses' sister Miriam. It was also this same Hur who was chosen to go with Moses and Aaron to the top of the mountain to prop up Moses' arms during Israel's first war against the Amalekites. That's in Exodus 17. So Bezalel is the grandson of Hur and the grandson of Miriam. Now Bezalel is a clear fractal of the Messiah, Yeshua. And I'll go through just some of those. Bezalel was a man called by name from the tribe of Judah, who was filled with the Spirit of God, the Ruach Elohim, to build the dwelling place of the Lord. Now, this is a very apt description of who Yeshua is. He's called by name. He's certainly filled with the Spirit of Elohim. And he certainly is the dwelling place of God on earth, the physical dwelling place of God on earth. This is one of the strong metaphors of the Gospel of John, that the real tabernacle, the real temple, and also in Revelation, that we will have no need of temples, is the Messiah. Because it's in Messiah that God will dwell among his people.
Now Moses was said to be so astonished at Bezalel's abilities that he said, Bezalel must have been in the shadow. This is a Talmudic story. While he received his visions at Sinai. The Talmud says, you were indeed in the shadow, for you have the ability to create what the Holy One, blessed be He, has commanded to me. And part of that story is based on the fact that Bezalel means, in Hebrew, the shadow of God. And Bezalel's chief assistant was Aholiab, a name that means my father's tent. Now Bezalel was also a fractal of Yeshua in that he was from the kingly tribe of Judah. He was a young carpenter. He was unusually filled with the Spirit of God. And his father's name is Uri, which means my light. And if you read James 1:17, every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of light. His assistant, Aholiab, was from the tribe of Dan, which means to judge. So Daniel means God's judge. So this symbolized the legal aspect. And it was he, rather than Moses, who actually built the Mishkan, which was the archetypal pattern, the fractal for the temple above, the temple not made with hands, the 4D temple. So Moses got all of the instructions, got the fractal, got the pattern, got the blueprint, seemed to be the man, but it was Bezalel who built it. So let me read to you from Hebrews chapter 3. Therefore, holy brothers, you who share in a heavenly calling, consider Yeshua, the apostle and the high priest of our confession, who was faithful to him who appointed him, just as Moses also was faithful in all God's house, this tabernacle. For Yeshua has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, as much more glory as the builder of a house has more honor than the house itself. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all God's house as a servant, to testify to the things that were to be spoken later. But Yeshua is faithful over God's house as a son, and we are his house if indeed we hold fast our confidence and our boasting and our hope. So there again, the author of Hebrews is making that connection that ultimately Yeshua is the builder. Now the Torah states that God endowed Bezalel with the Spirit of God, with wisdom, with understanding, and for those who really know it, there's really something right here.
God.
Knowledge. Kabbalah. These are also the same attributes used to describe God as the creator of the universe in Exodus 35 and in Proverbs 3. Now, according to the Talmud, Bezalel was just 13 years old when he began building the tabernacle. Now, think about this. He's a 13-year-old carpenter, but yet he's blowing the minds of people like Moses. Anyone else is around 12 or 13? And blowing the minds of people in the tabernacle, in the temple? Now, as a young man chosen by God himself, Bezalel came and healed the wound, as the Talmud describes it, that was caused by the sin of the golden calf. Midrash Rabbah Shemot describes Bezalel as the one who essentially healed the wound of the sin, atoned for the sin of the golden calf by his building of the tabernacle so that God could come and dwell, so that the sacrifices could be made and so forth. So again, a clear fractal of the Messiah. Okay. Further, the Talmud states that Bezalel, quote, and this is in Berachot 53, knew how to join together the letters which heaven and earth, with which heaven and earth were created. In other words, he had a deep understanding of the Torah and how everything really worked. A deep understanding of Hashem. And indeed, as the one who knew how to fashion the Ark of the Covenant where the blood would be presented for our atonement, he clearly foreshadowed Yeshua, our Messiah. So Bezalel is important to really pay attention to everything he does and says, because he is, in many ways, a Messiah of that generation. Remember, the fractal is, you got the big picture, you take a little portion out, and yet in that little portion, you got the whole thing. As above, so below. Usually I give you as below, so above. But I decided to trick it up a little bit to let you know it works in both ways. This week's Torah reading, Vayechel, and next week's Pekudei, are replete with all kinds of interesting questions for us. But the first is, why do these parashot exist at all? Most of their content seems completely unnecessary, and that's what I was getting at. Almost everything in this week and next week's reading, you have already read. You've literally already read it. So why? I mean, the Bible gives, what, two chapters, kind of, to creation. It gives just small amounts of information about things we consider really big. And yet, when it comes then to the tabernacle, we get over 13 chapters. And it's repeated like ad nauseum. You know, that doesn't seem, because what we think is important gets this small space, and what we think is insignificant is getting all this coverage. Okay. The Torah is very mincing with words. The Torah will give a word or two, and the Talmud will actually talk about it for 60 pages, that one word. Okay. Sometimes it'll even talk about why there's just an extra letter in a word for like 25 pages. But the Torah, though, is very economical, very condensed. But when it comes to the Mishkan, the sanctuary made by the people of Israel in the Sinai Desert, it does an very unusual thing. It elaborates. And then it elaborates some more. And then it elaborates some more. And then it repeats it. So first in Parashat Terumah and Tetzaveh, which we've already read, we get a description of every one of the sanctuary's dozens of components, all the way to like little pegs, as spelled out in God's instructions as fractal to Moses. Now, as I said, did anyone notice this week's reading? We get all of those details from those two Parashat again. In the account of the sanctuary's actual construction in the parashat of Vayechel and Pekudei. But the most amazing thing is that these two descriptions are virtually identical. But not quite. The only real difference is this. In the first account, the description of each item begins like this. And they shall make. Okay, and they shall make. And then it gives you what they're to make. But in the second account, it says, and they made. Okay. They shall make, and they made. As we'll see, this is no small thing. There is no small thing in the Torah. The sanctuary is the prototype or the fractal of the dwelling for God in the physical world, whose construction consists of our mission in life. That's why the details are so important. But why do they have to be related twice? Why couldn't the Torah just simply say in the sons of Israel, they built it exactly as God commanded? I mean, we could have lost the last chunk of Exodus. It could have just said, all that you just read where it said, and they shall make, they did it. Okay? Now, having been given rational brains by Hashem means that you not only know how things are, but you also understand how things ought to be. Which means you're constantly being made aware that things are not as they ought to be. Now, human beings, most of whom I think will agree have brains, deal with this frustration in a variety of ways. Some may become academics, which means they concentrate on the way things ought to be and may believe that's the way things actually are. I think we have a leader in our government like that. Hey, you know. Those who, for some reason, usually job-related, are compelled to deal with the way things actually are, us who have to deal with the idealistic God, try not to think about the way things ought to be, because we're too busy dealing with just what is. But neither approach can be maintained 100% of the time. And that's why we experience stress. So this has led humans to invent all sorts of balms and salves for our stress on the one hand, and all sorts of devices to do away with or at least numb our brain on the other. All of this is pretty much a shame, since it's pretty good having a brain, and it's actually healthy to experience stress if you know how to manage it. And that's the lesson that's implicit in these, which would seem to be bonus chapters in this week and next week's parashat. The Lubavitcher Rebbe explains that the Torah wants to emphasize in these last two readings that there will always be two versions of God's home on earth. The ideal version, as God envisions it and describes it to Moses, and the real version, as it is actually built in and out of our physical lives. In other words, it's going to be the 4D version and the 3D version. The world above, the world that comes version, and the way we experience it and deal with it in this world and in this, with our, you know, in our actual physical lives. Now, does this mean that God is making allowances, that his vision can be compromised by the way things are down here? No, because guess what? Both versions are exactly the same. In other words, as above, so below, and so below is above. And so what this means for us is that we are empowered and expected to recreate the divine ideal in its entirety, down to its very last peg, clasp, and carrying pole within this material world. We are to recreate, not duplicate. God doesn't want us to transform physical matter into substanceless spirit. He wants us to make the physical world hospitable to his presence. Being human never means you get to cease the effort to translate the ideal into the real. Part of attaching yourself to Yeshua the Messiah is transforming below as above. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, below as it is above. Okay. God is a covenant God. And while he is sovereign, he also built into that covenant a partnership with us. And we discussed that at the very beginning in creation. Can God do everything? Does God need us to help him to do anything and all of that? No. But for some reason, that's the system he's worked out. Okay? No, we cannot eliminate the gap between matter and spirit ourselves. Rather, what we do is make our lives a physical version of the divine vision. As above, so below. We see that everything happening in our lives in this physical universe has a spiritual counterpart in the world above. Okay, that they are interrelated, interconnected. And human life is an attempt to achieve the impossible, an attempt that, yes, fails, but yet in failing, achieve something even greater. That's part of the mitzvah, the commandments. They're connecting to Hashem. They're ways of connecting above and below. How do we here on earth, in our finite bodies, in our fallen world, in our broken lives, how do we possibly relate to that above? We connect. How do we connect? With the mitzvah. Okay. This is also what goes on when we, for instance, take communion. It's a mitzvah. Do this and remember to me. Do it. And when you do it, what's happening here at that table is above and below are intersecting. They are connecting. So that we join the four, it is, you know, what do we describe it? A foretaste of the feast to come. We join in, or what do we say? With all the saints, angels, saints, we laud and magnify your glorious name, praising you and singing, holy, holy, holy. Why do we sing holy, holy, holy? Because what do we hear in Isaiah 6 when Isaiah gets a glimpse into heaven? Holy, holy, holy. When John gets a glimpse into heaven, what's he hear? Holy, holy, holy. So when we are doing this particular mitzvah, do this, what are we seeing? Holy, holy, holy. Because we are as above, so below. Much of our liturgy is driven with this concept. That's why much of our liturgy is just repeating and saying what we know God has said to us first. And what we know as saints have always said. And so the two versions, and we'll come back to this probably a little bit more next week, reflect this idea. they will make and they made. Okay, we'll probably come back to that some next week. All right, I want to close with cerebral versus connecting. What does cerebral mean?
Brain.
Brain, kind of brain activity. Okay, nerds are very cerebral people. Okay. Now, after breaking the first set of tablets of the Ten Commandments, which was on what day? The 17th of Tammuz, right? Because Israel had her experience with the golden calf, which we learned last week. They didn't worship the golden calf. They thought they were worshiping the true God. Okay? Their idolatry was the fact that they had made a graven image to represent that true God. So Moses ascends Mount Sinai, and he spends 40 days there again praying for the forgiveness for his people. On the 10th day of Tishrei, 40 days later, which is Yom Kippur, his petition for pardon was granted by God, and he returns to the people. His first act on the next day, the 11th of Tishrei, Exodus 35, is the day after the very first Yom Kippur. He gathers the entire congregation, church of Israel, and he told them the things that God commanded us to do. And then his first lesson was the observance of Shabbat, singling out the creation of fire among all labor that was to be avoided on the holy day. So it's right there in the Torah, by the way, folks. Now, couldn't Moses have found something more ennobling to tell the children of Israel at that moment? That was a really big moment. You know, they thought they were going to be toast, eliminated, killed, forsaken, separated from God for eternity, and their sins are forgiven, and then Moses kind of gives them this. They were filled with this contrition. They had denied the basis of their faith, and now they had humbly sought to return to their God and were accepted. Now, from a Western point of view, and how most of our church bodies and our seminaries would have handled this situation on the 11th of Tishrei, would have been to lecture them on theology and expound the concepts of ethical monotheism, communion with the Creator through worship and meditation and other sorts. This would be the logical way of vitiating the influence of that calf cult, of ensuring there would not be a repeat of backsliding. In other words, let me shove the pure doctrine down your throat. That's the antidote for all that ails us. You do realize that. Pure doctrine is the solution to all of our problems. So I'm just going to shove doctrine and creeds and rules and regulations down your throat about what is the correct thing to believe. And that'll fix everything. Okay? That's how we handle it. But we find a different refrain in the Torah, the theme that permeates the Hebraic worldview. It is not the expounding of theology that is so important. It's rather deed. Or to put it another way, the Hebraic mind view is this. Talk is cheap. Don't talk the talk if you aren't going to walk the walk. The Hebraic worldview says, don't tell me what you think I should know. Don't tell me theology. Why don't you show me what it looks like being lived out by a real human being? Show me the money. Our greatest shield against assimilation, that is, our greatest shield and protection against becoming like the world, is not me shoving theology and doctrine down your throat. The guarantor of our faith integrity isn't our theology. It is connecting to Hashem through His Messiah. In other words, it's not, do you know Jesus? It's not even, do you believe in Jesus? It is, do you follow Jesus? I don't care what you know. Show me what you do. That's what Moses was doing. That's why it begins with the Shabbat. If we are connecting to Hashem, and if we are attaching ourselves to Yeshua, then the theology and the doctrine, which is important, that will come in its time. What is important for us is not so much if our theology is 100% pure, as is it is, are we carrying out God's will in our daily living. This is the author of Hebrews' point when he says, look, you guys are wasting way too much time.
You should be far more advanced than you are. But you keep quibbling about baptism and washing your hand and all of these other little goofy things. All of these doctrines and theologies, and you aren't maturing in your faith. Grow up.
You're totally distracted.
Devotion to God can be developed only through Yeshua's teachings and actually living out those teachings of Yeshua. Sermon on the Mount. Anyone here not agree that the Sermon on the Mount would be a nice, good example, a solid, full sampling of the teachings of Yeshua? You know, the full thing, the full four chapters, yeah. It's a good, like, if someone said, look, give me something substantive, not a couple of verses, but give me a good chunk where I can get exposed to who Yeshua is. Sermon on the Mount, a pretty good example. Not one time does Yeshua tell you what to believe. He doesn't talk about anything about believing anything or anybody. He talks about doing and being and being. Doing and being.
Like taking the speck out of your being out of your eye. And
The Hebraic mindset could care less if you know all the books of the Bible and that you can win Bible trivia on Friday nights with your friends. That's good stuff. I'm definitely not saying don't be familiar with your Bible. But it also wants to know, okay, what you doing with that? So you know all the teachings of Yeshua. Do you love? Do you love your neighbors, yourself? How many have heard of Albert Schweitzer? Okay. Lutheran, by the way. I think part of the University of Strasbourg where I get to stay too. Okay, he's much maligned in the Christian church and evangelical Protestant circles because of some of his understandings of who Jesus was and what Jesus did and how he understood the Gospels and so forth, by the way, which were largely Hebraic. But what's funny when I thought about this today was most of the people that criticized in the past tense, and still do today, even though he's long gone, and what he did was almost 100 years ago, people who criticized and criticize him do so from the comforts of their seminary offices, with their high paychecks, and their books, and their health plans, and their insurances, and from their comfortable pulpits, where they go home and live in their parsonages and so forth. But you know what? Albert Schweitzer was a physician. He sold everything he had, gave everything he had, including his cash, away, and moved to a place in Africa and treated sick people in Africa. Which one was more like Yeshua? Which one got Yeshua? Now, so Schweitzer's theology cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs? Yeah, it was. It was. But he still seemed to grasp something that the people in the ivory tower didn't. People in the ivory tower knew all the right answers. They did. They knew the right answers. And they had the right answers. But one sold everything he had because he loved his neighbor more than himself. Rav Shaul. Though you have pure doctrine, as he says, and though you have everything in the world, if you don't have love, you've got nothing. You've got nothing. In other words, if you don't do and you don't be, you've got nothing. I don't care what's up here. What's coming out here? Church shies away from this because, am I teaching you're saved by what you do? No, I'm not. You're saved by God's grace and by God's grace alone, and if He hadn't called you by the Holy Spirit and made you aware of your need of salvation, which comes through His Son, you'd be in bad shape. I'm talking about what happens after God calls you and God enlightens you and God makes you aware of this. What happens then? then it's not you working for your salvation. Then it's you responding and following your master. Discipleship in the Hebraic sense is not just adhering to, I like what that guy says. Discipleship means emulating your teacher, emulating the one you're following. But I'm not the Son of God in the flesh. I can't be perfect. Okay. It doesn't mean you can't try. You don't get off the hook by doing that. And that's the beauty of, in our failure, we accomplish. How many times have I taught in this class and given you examples in the Torah? One step back always is followed by two steps forward. So you'll fail. And you'll mess up, but you'll always be one step ahead of where you were. Cerebral versus connecting. Moses was about connecting. That's why he didn't give a theological lecture on monotheism. All right. Any questions or comments? Yes.
Why did they dye the hides red?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. Honestly, I don't. I'll have to look into that. I honestly don't know the answer to that. Yeah.
Going back to Kahal,
uh-huh.
We were on Sunday in church talking about getting into the Cicero and Philippi and instead of time with God, I will build my.
So yeah. That's where I'm going to build my assembly, the people dedicated to my holy cause. I'm going to build them right here in the midst of all of this darkness. That's part. It's not that he would have set up that change. It's what eventually nothing else was called an ecclesia except this institution that we call the church. And so over time, it quit meaning assembly in the generic sense and came to mean church, as you know. But that was not what was in the mind of the first century hearers at all. At all. You know.
That's why it's so important to learn Hebrew.
Yes, it is. It is. Or just get familiar with the culture. I mean, any good commentary hopefully would give you that kind of information. You can't read 21st century thoughts and ideas and worldviews and reactions into first century people. You know, you got to know. Just like, you know, when you watch the History Channel and they read you letters from the Civil War and so forth. I mean, those letters sound so foreign to us and crazy, you know, and that was just 100 years ago, you know, how the language has changed and how we communicate. So we've got to know what it meant to those people before we can, well, the way, you know, it was always put to me, you got to know what it meant before you know what it means. Yeah, we got to know what it meant before you know what it means. And, you know, again, you know, this makes a lot of, like, you know, my fellow pastors nervous. It makes me the black sheep of pastors' conferences and so forth. But we've just got to radically rethink what church is. You know, and it makes them uncomfortable on many levels, theological levels, but it makes them uncomfortable on a personal level because this is my job. You might be suggesting, like, I don't know, everyone can kind of do this kind of thing? Where am I going to get my paycheck from, you know, kind of thing. It goes all the way from a very theological level to a very practical level. And it's very much what Yeshua was saying. Yeshua wasn't opposing Torah or anything like that. He was saying, you know what, we got to rethink this whole who's in leadership role. You know, we got to rethink, you know, turning over the tables in the temple. He's basically saying, we got to rethink how this stuff, what this was supposed to be and what it's become. And that, you know, that makes a lot of people uncomfortable, especially those who are in positions of authority in the institution and saying we got to radically rethink. But we do. We've got to radically rethink it because this is not, I mean, again, and I'm the pastor and all, this is not
Yeshua's image in Matthew 16 and 18 at the church. And it's not. Not that good stuff doesn't come out of it, not that God doesn't work through it. He does. It is good. It wouldn't exist if God wasn't guiding it. Does it play, you know, is all of this fitting into how it's supposed to be? Yes. But also, again, there's that partnership where we're also to be affecting change in this too. How, you know, how does change come about to the people of God? Through the people of God.
And that's what the Pharisees, if you read it that way, it's a fractal of what the church is becoming.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And in fact, you know, I always said it, and there's, I don't know how many of you know Henry in town, the little local author. You met Henry? He's kind of old, gray hair and beard and so forth. He's a fascinating guy. You know, every once in a while he comes to church here, or he'll call and ask me to go to breakfast and so forth. But he and I talked about an idea, and even wrote a book about this idea, that the first coming of Yeshua, Messiah, is a fractal of the second coming. Meaning, you know, hopefully you kind of know how to describe six circular patterns and so forth, so nothing new under the sun. So we really shouldn't expect a second coming to have these anything that we haven't seen before. And what did we see in his first coming? Was that those who should have recognized him and embraced him and loved him and welcomed him were the ones who denied him, rejected him, and felt threatened by him, shut him down. Even ones who knew what he was saying was true still shut him down because of what he represented. And then the ones who should have never known who he was, should have never got it, didn't deserve it, they were the ones that embraced it. So in his second coming, who should recognize them and embrace them and love them? The church. But when he comes with his peyotes, his talit, and looks like a rabbi from the Galilee, the church is going to say, and wanting to, you know, observe Shabbat, the church is going to say, no, we've got too much invested in this other stuff. We've got way too much invested. The Vatican, we've got way too much invested for you not to be who we said you were. And yet, who do we think shouldn't recognize them and has rejected them? His own brothers. So, that's the thing. And so, when you think about it in the second coming, you know, when he returns, it's going to be very similar. You know, there'll be an Antichrist, and so we're going to have to ask ourselves, just like Peter and John and all of them did, is this really the one? Because everyone's saying there's no way this is the one. But he sure seems like he's the one. Yeah, and that's where I think the church has to do a lot of rethinking. I think it's the importance of the Hebraic Roots movement that goes on, is going on across denominations. I think it's getting in touch with who Jesus really is. Who he really is. What he was really about. And in many ways, it's a new reformation, if you will. It's a new reformation. Which the reformers said, you know, semper reformata. The church always has to be reforming, always has to be asking itself difficult. When the church starts asking itself difficult questions and stops being introspective and starts and stops correcting herself, that's when it's in trouble. You know, and in many ways, it's, you know, what I try to do on Torah Tuesday is not to convert you, you know, you who aren't members of Emmanuel, I've never invited you to Emmanuel or invited you to a Lutheran induction class or something like that. It isn't to convert you. It isn't to change your mind. It isn't to make you what I believe. I want you just to think deep thoughts and ask yourself good questions. You know, it's okay to question, why have I always believed this? Why have this always been taught? Why isn't church in the Old Testament? You know, I just want you to ask good questions, deep questions, and not be afraid of asking them. You know, this is a safe place to be a follower of Jesus, a believer in Jesus, but a safe place to still ask questions. And to say, you know, maybe we've gone off path somewhere. And I really think the Hebraic Roots is the way back.
only Lutheran pastor to teach it.
For those not here, you don't get to hear this comment. We will now stop the recorder.